Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Media mergers seem the order of the day. Time Warner and AT&T want to get together, something the Trump administration wants to block. Tribune and Sinclair, two groups that own stations across the country, are also interested in merging, although Ajit Pai, chairman of the FCC, seems opposed. Meanwhile, Disney, owner of ABC, scored a knockout over NBC's owner, Comcast, coming out the winner in the effort to acquire the TV and movie studio properties of 21st Century Fox. Locally, Raycom Media, owner of WBTV, wants to get hitched to another company in Georgia, which would make them the third largest local television broadcaster in the country. And Cox Media Group, which owns Charlotte's WSOC-TV, is exploring a sale of its television assets. Why all these mergers? What's going on? And more importantly, is this a good thing or a bad thing for you and your viewing habits and for the country at large? We're going to pose those questions and more to NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Welcome to the program, David.
Hey, thank you so much.
You're welcome. These mergers and proposed mergers are just the latest wave. We've kind of seen this before. In days of yore, no owner could own more than seven television, seven AM, seven FM stations. But that kind of went by the wayside in the 70s. And then again in the 90s, we ended up with a company like Clear Channel that owned thousands of radio stations at one point around the country. But last November, the FCC and its chairman, Ajit Pai, voted to eliminate even more restrictions. What did this 3-2 vote on the commission, I think it was, what did this vote do?
Well, they were sweeping away a couple of different kinds of regulations and rules. But the key one in my mind was that there was this rule that had been dropped back in the day that treated, if you remember back on the dial, there were VHF stations in TV and UHF stations in TV. And the idea was that the big network channels for NBC, ABC, CBS down were the lower numbers. Those were VHF channels, and they were counted at a greater rate in terms of how many stations you owned, how many markets you were reaching and the like, than were the UHF, which were on what were considered weaker transmitters, weaker signals, weaker antennae. Now, you know, 85% of the country that watches TV is doing so through cable and satellite. So the number you are on the dial doesn't really matter. You know, there even for local stations, it just doesn't have any technological purchase. What Ajit Pai pushed through, and as the New York Times showed and investigators for the Democrats on the Senate side, I believe, and the House side of Congress were able to show, was that he did this in real consultation with a former FCC official who became a lobbyist for Sinclair. What they did was essentially restored that discount. That is, they counted the what had been historically the UHF stations, the weaker stations, and said they only count as 50% of a station, which allowed Sinclair broadcast based outside Baltimore to acquire and add far more stations than they otherwise would have been allowed to do. And let's give listeners a sense of what that means. Sinclair Broadcast owns and controls in excess of 190 stations across the country. When I first started covering media for the Baltimore Sun in 2000, they, if I recall correctly, owned, I think it was 40-some stations and controlled another 20 more. And I thought that was a lot. Well, here they are with 190. They want to add 42. They'll sell some, or if this deal were improbably somehow to go through now. But Ajit Pai basically was the government architect for a change in policy, restoring a completely archaic way of thinking about television stations in what was clearly considered a concerted effort to ensure that this deal could go through. That is, he had seemingly greased the skids from the outset. And that was the kind of regulation that the newly elevated chairman of the FCC under President Trump, that's the way he was going to do things.
So let me think. This is very confusing, I'm sure, for our listeners. It's confusing for me, and I kind of understand it.
Forgive me for that.
No, that's okay. In the old days, if VHF, the channels 2 through 13, I think it is, over the air had more power and therefore more coverage and more influence, while the UHF stations, channel 14 and above, had less power, and therefore they only counted 50%. In the cable and satellite world, where everything is equal, why would you continue to give a discount to UHF?
Well, it would be something you might want to do if you philosophically were against significant restrictions on media ownership.
Mm-hmm.
I think what Sinclair has done represents an extraordinary consolidation of the ownership of local TV stations across the country. And it is, in a sense, intent or trying to build up a national network from the bottom up, that is through the acquisitions of so many stations that in standardizing programming and particularly news programming across its ranks, it can have a somewhat unified voice in many markets across the country, including a lot of swing states. What's another element? Well, you could argue it's the coziness between regulators and lobbyists and power, influential figures and influence peddlers in D.C. Or you could take a look at what Sinclair represents. Sinclair Broadcast is yet another major pillar in the pantheon of conservative media outfits that serve as a to bolster the president's standing with his most loyal devotees out there. Why do I say that? I say that because of the kinds of segments that they require their news programs to carry across the country that are by and large extremely sympathetic to the Trump administration. In addition, you know, the Sunday public affairs show that Sinclair runs on its programs and other segments that are so-called must carries in which station anchors have been required by Sinclair corporate executives to essentially denounce other media outlets as helping to distribute and disseminate fake news. It really all adds up to a constantly friendly and welcoming space for the president and his supporters.
This is Sinclair is an organization that people in Charlotte, if they live here and don't travel around a lot, are not going to be aware of because there's no Sinclair station. And in fact, it's been called the biggest media company you've never heard of. But they own a lot of stations. And as you say, they not only run editorials that are produced at the mothership, at the home headquarters, which are then aired on all of their broadcast stations, they also write copy for news anchors to read. So it look with a point of view. So it looks like the local news people are reporting the facts as they know them, when in fact they're reading something that's been written for them with an agenda in mind from the home office, essentially. Some people would look at that and say, well, so what? Newspapers do that. They run syndicated columns and they take a point of view. What's wrong with that?
Right. I think it's fine for news organizations to have point of view. I think it's great for news organizations to be conservative, to be liberal, to be libertarian, be something else. I think that's fine. I think it's good if it's clear, if that's going to permeate all of the coverage, that's the kind of news organization it is. I think it's important for it to be labeled if they want to guide their coverage to be, fair-minded and to be non-ideological. All that's fine. The thing that I object to so much is not that there was a corporate message put out. I think that should be done in the voice and the person of the corporate executives making the commentaries, or perhaps a station executive saying that he's doing this on behalf of corporate ownership. Where I have a problem is in having local anchors, many of whom may build up a relationship and a sense of trust with their audiences over a series of years, putting it in the first person and saying, I have come to believe, I am concerned, I fear.
Have any of them balked?
I think in a couple of instances, I believe there was one station perhaps in Wisconsin that refused to do it. And there are a couple of smaller episodes of individual anchors or hosts declining to do it, and others being sort of substituted in their wake. But this was mandated from corporate headquarters. It was I read the full memo. They said it had to be done away from the news desk, so it didn't seem like a newscast. It was clearly more a personal addressing the audience as a they said, as a way to distinguish it from the newscast, which I think is probably true, but also in an effort to, I think, be a little bit more engaging and personalized. But, I mean, they dictated things down to the colors of the men's ties in these presentations. These were very carefully thought through. Corporate executives said, you know, we were trying to do this in a nonpartisan way and talk about how we are credible and we work to keep faith. And at the very end of it, they say, you know, if you have any concerns with our coverage, you should send us a note through such and such portal. But it came off as slamming the news, their competitors in the news space and other news organizations as fake news. And it also came off as though there were hundreds of seemingly organic outcries of conscience by these anchors across the country who all happened to choose exactly the same language verbatim.
So Sinclair wanted to merge with Tribune Media because that would give them instant access to major markets like New York and Los Angeles, where Tribune has owned stations for years. And I was going to talk about this later because if I understand this correctly, this merger didn't pass muster, which is odd because, as you say, Sinclair's been very pro-Trump. Why then would this not pass muster? Why would it be shot down?
A very fair question. So in acquiring these 42 stations, Sinclair still runs afoul of or awfully close to running afoul of some other restrictions and regulations about the percentage of the audience you can reach in any given, you know, you're going to trap in any given market, how many stations you own in a given market, depending on its size, what percentage of the nation you reach, a lot of these things. So even as a lot of restrictions were swept aside, Sinclair had to make some sort of acknowledgement of reality on this, and so proposed to sell off a couple of stations in Texas, a major station in Chicago, as well as a small group of others. Among the companies they were going to sell to involved at least two companies that seemed awfully closely aligned with Sinclair itself. Sinclair is a publicly traded company on the financial markets, but it's controlled by the Smith family, Baltimore County, the Smith brothers. One of the companies was founded by a former Sinclair executive, but 92%, at least previously, 92% owned by the chairman's mother. And another company was controlled by the conservative commentator Armstrong Williams, who for a number of years in the first decade of the 2000s was employed by Sinclair. And these are the kinds of deals that tend to raise questions about the degree of distance and independence that these stations would have from Sinclair itself. I mean, if Sinclair is supposed to be divesting of these companies, selling these companies, it doesn't make sense that they would still essentially exert ownership control over them. They were intended under these deals to still operate them. The FCC finally presented with a lot of evidence, concluded, Ajit Pai among them, the commissioners concluded that this raised grave questions about both the independence of the stations, but also about, and this was astonishing to see, but Ajit Pai issued statements saying he questioned the veracity of statements submitted to him by Sinclair. So this company that he had worked hard to essentially sweep away all kinds of regulations to aid suddenly presented questions of whether or not he believed them. I think it's worth pointing out, they said, listen, we've been very transparent about this. We'll tweak the deal in hopes of winning your support. They failed to win that support. But to be fair to Sinclair, you know, the nature of these companies has been known for years. You know, Armstrong Williams' relationship with Sinclair is not something that was only recently revealed. The nature of another or two of the companies, these are companies we've known about for some time. So, you know, it is worth pointing out that the chairman, Ajit Pai, is under essentially investigation by the inspector general of the FCC for the way in which he originally scrapped a lot of those restrictions that benefited Sinclair. And it may well be that that kind of scrutiny led him to look a lot harder at the merits of what Sinclair was actually offering.
We're talking about the impact of mergers and acquisitions in the broadcast world and the cable world. And we'll continue our conversation with David Folkenflik in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Folkenflik is with us. He's our media correspondent at NPR, and we're talking about this flurry of mergers and acquisitions. We've talked about Sinclair, which may or may not happen now, but Time Warner and AT&T. Time Warner exists because of previous mergers. Same is true of AT&T. We know AT&T is the phone company and the wireless company. We know that Time Warner is a former cable company, but they want to come together. Why?
Well, and to be fair, they have come together. AT&T actually already acquired Time Warner. It is running its former media properties under the title of Warner Media, because although the federal government challenged this in court, the top Justice Department officials on antitrust said this was too much of a consolidation of all this and lost sweepingly. They're challenging it again. So they're being operated separately. What this was this was a union of two companies that kind of occupied adjoining halves of the same kind of entity, which is to say that you have Time Warner's producing all this content. Time Warner includes CNN, it includes HBO, the Cartoon Channel, TBS, TNT, a bunch of stations you can watch Law & Order on ad nauseum, right? And at Warner Brothers Studios and other properties. And over there at AT&T, they had essentially the tubes it was going to come in through. AT&T has a modest cable shop. It owns DirecTV, and it's one of the nation's largest broadband providers. So one way and another, AT&T really wants content that it can shoot through those tubes and right. offer better deals on its mobile apps. That's the idea behind it. Government said this would be too big. AT&T and Time Warner said, you guys haven't challenged a deal where that is not a combination of actual competitors in about 40 years, and the judge agreed with them.
So this brings up a brand new question. In the old days, these mergers of broadcast companies dealt with having too many stations, having too much influence on too few viewers and too few listeners. This brings up something different, because now you have a content provider who has combined forces with the pipe provider, and there is some concern. AT&T wanted to do this because they thought they couldn't survive in a Netflix world. So now they own HBO. Will they then throttle back Netflix for people getting their content from that company in order to improve HBO's prospects?
Well, I think this is an excellent question, because one of the things you saw under the FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai was that they unwound what was called net neutrality,
right.
which is to say that broadband providers had to treat all content similarly and not discriminate, much in the same way the phone company can't discriminate if you're calling somebody, you know, that they like or somebody they don't like. And, you know, companies have argued that it would be self-defeating to do this and that it would cause pandemonium. You have a company like Comcast, which is one of the nation's, which is the nation's largest broadband provider, and also has the NBC network and MSNBC, and it the Universal Pictures and all kinds of stuff, and it too sees itself as a competitor to Netflix. But Netflix can't survive without Comcast and AT&T and other major providers really taking care of them. So it's a this is a world where you've got some major players, which have enormous market caps that are just enormous sides that are going at each other from different ends of the telescope.
And so you have Sinclair and Tribune, a merger that kind of, or at least a company that favors Donald Trump, and probably Donald Trump was in favor of that merger, and that's been shot down. Meanwhile, Donald Trump raged on the campaign trail about CNN, which is owned by Time Warner, which is now owned by AT&T and operated as Warner, and yet this merger goes through. How do you explain that?
A lot of it, I think you have to look at the atmospherics that, for example, the judge, the federal judge in the case refused to allow into discussion, which is what is the president's mood on these things? President Trump is a fan put it this way, is an ally of Rupert Murdoch, who's a top Fox and Fox News and that empire, which, as you pointed out at the top, is pursuing a deal with Disney to sell off most of its properties, although not Fox News itself. Trump basically called Rupert Murdoch to congratulate him on the deal. That is a deal, an acquisition of rivals and competitors, a seemingly more direct case of a question of antitrust. Trump has smiled on that. Trump has frowned on the campaign trail and as president on the AT&T Time Warner deal. Now, he did it with a populist bent to it. He said it's too big, it's too powerful, these media titans are too large. But he also coupled that with direct criticism and antagonism and a verbal assault on CNN, one of the most famous titles in the Time Warner portfolio. And it's very hard to disaggregate this very unusual essentially attempt to block the merger of AT&T and Time Warner from the president's anger about what he sees as, or characterizes, I should say, as CNN's wrongful coverage of him.
Meanwhile, Comcast, which was at one point an upstart cable company, bought NBC's properties several years ago. Disney bought ABC and its properties several years ago. And now, for a while at least, they've been engaged in this battle to take on the assets of 21st Century Fox, the entertainment assets of 21st Century Fox. Comcast backed out. Why?
Comcast was fighting hard for Fox and seemingly was going to have to increase its bidding to the point where it, almost a level of insanity. And, you know, what it successfully did was force Disney to pay a whole lot more than it wanted to and expected to for the right to take over Fox. I mean, it increased it almost by an order of $20 billion from, I think it was $52, $53 billion to about $71 billion. That's a whole lot of money. Now, it also had in its sights one of Murdoch's international jewels, and that's Sky Broadcast. Murdoch and 21st Century Fox control 39% of it. The Murdochs have been fighting for years, stretching back almost a decade, to repurchase the other 61%. And there have been a series of scandals in Britain and the U.S. that have interfered with the Murdoch's abilities to do that. Regulators, even sympathetic to the Murdochs, have at times thrown barriers in their way. And just when the Murdochs were getting approval, finally, after promising for the independence and the financial security of Sky News, a respected kind of non-Fox News channel that they operate in Britain and in Europe, just at that point, Comcast comes in and offers a much higher bid for it. You know, at this point, Murdoch is essentially, even though he had wanted it for himself, once he came to terms with selling most of the company to Disney, he had thought he would basically acquire Sky and turn it over to Disney as this great entree into foreign markets for Disney. And Comcast coming in and said, you know, if we can't have Fox itself, we're going to go for the international markets and take that. And they have upped and beaten the Murdoch's offer each time. So it looks as though Comcast is poised to steal that away and has using that as a consolation for not winning the big prize here at home.
So let's be clear here. Disney's going to get this. They're going to get the entertainment properties of 21st Century Fox. They're not getting the local Fox television stations. They're not getting the Fox TV network. And they're not getting Fox News.
That's correct. And these, because ABC has local stations, Disney has ABC local stations, it has ABC Network, and it has ABC News, those were seen as more direct rivals to the point where that might compel the antitrust division of the Justice Department's hand. That is, that it couldn't swallow that. That would be a bridge too far. So the Murdochs are going to hold on to that and some of their sports properties as a way of building around what they call live programming. I think you're going to see a concentration on reality shows on the Fox network, news on their local stations, and news, of course, on Fox News as well, plus sporting events.
Well, I was going to ask you about this because the buzzword that you hear behind all of these mergers, and not just the mergers in broadcasting, mergers in every business, is that bigger is better, and that if you don't grow, you die. Well, Rupert Murdoch is downsizing. How will he survive?
Well, look, Murdoch is in his late 80s. He's on his fourth marriage, and he's recovering from what was a pretty nasty spill on his son Lachlan's yacht early this year. I think that what you've seen is that he basically – you saw Lachlan and James, his sons, talking about scalability, and that means who's going to be big enough to fight off the streamers of Netflix and of Amazon and soon of Apple, these giant companies, tech companies that are going to really challenge the standard Hollywood ones. They talked about how Fox was scalable, and by that they meant how big it was and how they'd be one of the ones. And Rupert concluded two things. First, he concluded that Fox was not likely to be actually big enough to stave that off. And he wanted to seek safe harbor at a place that could pay premium money for him. And the second thing was he concluded that this would be a way to kind of just resolve for once and for all the dynastic questions of which of his children would be leading his company. Would they be up to the effort? Could they work together? And the answer is he's going to have a smaller core company that he's going to let his son Lachlan run. His son James is going to go off and try to forge his own identity. And that's going to be the answer to this bloodless Game of Thrones that's been playing out in the Murdoch family for many years now.
This all sounds like the television show Succession, quite honestly.
Which it is.
we talked about Sinclair a minute ago, Sinclair's attempted merger with Tribune, which would have given them how many stations? 200 and some stations?
It probably would have been in excess, I want to get this right, of 230. They would have sold, I believe, 7 stations, depending on, how it played out, give or take. But certainly in excess of 220.
So there was some concern about them owning too many stations and having too much influence. Raycom, which owns one of our local stations, WBTV, a longtime CBS affiliate here, along with Raycom Sports, wants to merge with something called Gray Television out of Georgia. That would create the third largest broadcast group in the United States. Raycom, I think, provides services for over 60 TV stations already in 20 states, and that combination would evolve into 140 stations in 92 markets. Would similar concerns be operable here about having too much coverage and too much influence?
I mean, from a consumer advocacy point of view and from the question of the desire for multiple voices, I would say those are legitimate concerns. You know, advocates of such deals say the real question is to look at it market by market. And if there's not if Raycom is not controlling too many voices in the same market, then, there are, newspapers and publications. There are local TV stations in a given market. Presumably, there'll be websites as well. If anything, there are more voices than there used to be. But that's not really how it always works out. And oftentimes, particularly with companies like Raycom and like Sinclair, the reason they have so many stations is often because they're operating duopolies in the same market. They can save costs by having the same backroom team and often the same news team create the programming and sell the ads against both stations. So you don't have different voices in the same market. So you don't have truly different sensibilities.
Is it really that much different than having NBC, ABC, CBS having affiliates in each of the markets, running the same program from 8 o'clock till 11 o'clock every night, running a network newscast in the nighttime, a network newscast in the morning, or for that matter, NPR being on all these stations around the country? What's the difference? That's a tremendous amount of influence.
That is a tremendous amount of influence. I would say one of the things to look at is that relatively, ABC, NBC, CBS own relatively few stations in the low double digits.
Yeah, but they don't have to own them. They've got 3 hours of primetime every night. They've got a couple of hours of morning news. They've got syndicated programming that they sell to stations around the country. They've got their evening newscasts. What's the difference?
I think it's a fair question. I think local ownership, local ownership allows for the, diversity in local ownership allows for different voices to emerge about issues the closest to the viewers themselves. You know, if you have only ABC, NBC, CBS owning the stations, then the coverage in the local markets are going to be dictated from New York and those corporate corner offices in a way that I think will be ultimately a disservice to people in those markets. You're not wrong. There are large organizations, including mine, including USA Today, which owns stations as part of the Gannett company. Newspapers as part of the Gannett company all over the country and has a kind of normalization or standardization of certain kinds of coverage there. Consolidation in the media industry is an important and difficult question, in part because by having scale, by having size, major news organizations can afford to send people to Iraq and keep them for over a decade, to have reporters fan out all over the country to cover disasters in Puerto Rico and elsewhere. You do want a certain kinds of critical mass, both in the finances and the journalistic muscle power. to arise so that people can do things more meaningful than just sort of scrambling after the latest click.
But is the deck being stacked against this this kind of operation in the 21st century, particularly in America, where the FCC has for years had this local studio rule, which was designed to ensure that local residents could have a say in their local station's operations because it required broadcasters operating in those cities to have a physical studio in the area. Now that's been erased. That was taken away, I think, last fall.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. And, you know, you've seen that in television. You know, radio, I think, is particularly amazing, where you'll have at times major, you know, drive time shows being operated from different cities. And a DJ will take on different names in different markets, but do it from the same studio. Right. And I think there is a homogenizing of content, often a lack of imagination and certainly a lack of local connection with the markets. NPR doesn't own any of its local stations. And you can argue that there's a, you know, a standardization of the kinds of shows because a lot of stations, including FAE, control, you know, will take certain programs offered by the national network. But we don't control, you know, we have certain ethics and standards of NPR stations, member stations, as I understand it. So there's got to be a compliance with, you know, what we see as ethical news judgment. But we don't dictate what gets covered or how it's covered. And I think it's in those ventures and those activities that local stations can prove their creativity, but also prove their journalistic worth.
So we have about 90 seconds left. As you look from the 30,000 feet and you look at all these mergers, and some of them involve content providers and pipe providers, what do you see the impact being on viewers?
I think that viewers are ultimately, you know, rarely benefit from increased consolidation, particularly of local markets. I think that, you know, you just want, if you look at the coverage of the wars, the buildup to the war in Iraq, the McClatchy Company, a confederation of regional newspapers, gave in some ways the most journalistically rigorous and skeptical coverage of the claims being used in advance of that invasion. You know, there are times where the major news outlets that we trust and admire swing and miss. And, you know, I think that too much consolidation ultimately will mean fewer voices and fewer chances for alternative coverage to revise and correct the mistakes of their brethren. After all, we're all supposed to compete with each other, not simply because it's fun, but because at times, you know, journalists need to be held to account as well as anybody else.
David Falkenflik is media correspondent for NPR. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Man came by to hook up my cable TV. We settled in for the night, my baby and me. We switched round and round till half past dawn. There was 57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing on.
The South is responsible for the three greatest beverages in human history: sweet tea, Coca-Cola, and most of all, bourbon. And nobody alive has been involved with more bourbon than a man named Jimmy Russell. Listen to Jimmy Russell's interview on the latest episode of the Southbound Podcast, available for free on NPR One and wherever you find podcasts. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In addition to all of the changes in media we've been talking about, there are other items warranting concern, not the least of which is the constant battering of the media by the President of the United States. He has called journalists by many names, but the most concerning of all is enemy of the people. This has some journalists concerned for their safety, and they should be. Just witness the vitriol on display at Trump rallies.
You can hear there is a chorus of boos and other chants from this Trump crowd here in Tampa, Florida. They're saying things like CNN sucks, go home, and fake news.
But at least one journalist believes the media shouldn't get caught up in themselves and the attacks being launched against them. Columbia Journalism Review editor and publisher Kyle Pope has long asserted that the media need to stop treating Trump's war with the press as if it's the most important thing happening in the country and start listening again and reporting the kinds of stories that matter in people's lives. Here for the remainder of the hour to help us understand how we might do that is Kyle Pope. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Depending on which columnists and editorials you read and on which TV news outlets you watch, you can either be very comfortable with the president's attacks on the media or horrified by them. But putting the right or wrong of these attacks aside for the moment, the president could not be successful without the support of his core group of followers. So what has led to their anger at the press and their distrust of the media, which predated Mr. Trump's arrival at the White House?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that Trump did not, you know, invent this animosity towards the media. It predated him. What I think he did was he very effectively tapped into it, and he gave people a language to describe something that they'd sort of been feeling in their gut for a while, which was, you know, the press doesn't seem to care about me. They even sort of make fun of me. They're sort of look down on me. They're sort of paternalistic towards me. They don't write about stuff that I care about. And this had been sort of bubbling for a while. And one of the ways you know this is you can see readership and subscriptions to newspapers around the country have been dipping for a while. So there'd been this sort of like the sort of sense that there was something wrong with the way that the press was covering people's lives. Trump tapped into it very effectively. And again, he gave a language that people now can use to describe it.
A year ago, in the summer of 2017, you wrote that we need to start listening again and reporting the kinds of stories that matter in people's lives. We need to make it clear that we're in our reader's corner, not in the pocket of the source who gave us the tip in the first place. First of all, how do you do that? But secondly, why are we giving the impression that we are in the pocket of people who gave us the tip in the first place?
You know, we and a lot of other people did a lot of soul-searching after the 2016 election. And let's remember, essentially not a single news outlet was expecting Trump to win. And there wasn't even a very clear understanding of who was voting for him. And there was I can tell you, having talked to a lot of people who covered the campaign, there was just a sense of shock. And to me, that was a fundamental failure. I mean, this was like the biggest story. A presidential election is the biggest story that we have every 4 years, and the press essentially missed it. They misunderstood the level of support for Trump. And so we and a lot of other people started to look back on what were the kind of stories that were being written during the campaign, and it was overwhelmingly focused on the horse race. In other words, you know, what were the polls showing? Who was up? Who was down? It was focused on, there were a few sort of pet issues. Hillary's emails was one of them. There was a lot of focus on personality and sort of, especially with Trump, and not very much reporting on stuff that people have since told us was really important to them, like what's going to happen to my taxes or what's going to happen to my school board or what's going to happen to healthcare. The amount of column inches and airtime devoted to those subjects versus the amount of column inches devoted to those other horse race sort of personality issues was way out of whack. And I think that, you know, I just don't think that people, the reporters are writing the kind of stories that people really cared about.
Well, blame for that can certainly be placed on cable news. And I think they're doing it again with the midterms. They're not really talking about the issues that are taking people to the polls. They're talking about, will there be a blue wave? It's all about numbers. Who's going to win the race? Why haven't we learned?
Yeah. I mean, it's depressing, right? The other thing that's really amazing that you've seen, especially on cable news, is the sort of complete blurring of the line between news reporting and opinion reporting.
Yes.
Both, and it happens on both the left and the right.
Yes.
You have, you know, people complain about Fox News and how it's sort of in the tank for the president and everything is sort of one-sided. Frankly, if you watch MSNBC, especially at night, it's exactly the same as just on the other side of the aisle.
Yes.
And I've argued a lot with the people who run these networks, and they'll say, well, we do news until whatever time, 8 o'clock, and then we switch to opinion. And I'm like, well, where's the sort of sign that says, okay, now we're going from one thing to the other? Like, where's the placard that goes up and says, now you're in opinion zone? And there's just this kind of ebbing and flowing from one to the other. And it's no reason that people don't don't trust
But don't
guys.
People see that? You know it. I know it. When I watch it, if you watch Shepard Smith on Fox News, he's doing the news. And he will take issue with Sean Hannity, who says he says is not telling the truth. That's on Fox.
Yeah.
And he's on in the daytime. Yeah. Sean's on at night. Why don't people see that? Why don't they know the daytime is the news and the nighttime is entertainment?
It's not even that clean, because once in a while you'll have people, you know, you'll have some of the news reporters on at night who are sort of playing their reporter hat.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think it has to do with the sort of siloization of information where, you know, essentially people are tuning into and reading stuff that feeds their perception of what they want to hear.
So if
you want to be outraged about something the president did today, especially about Russia, you know where on MSNBC
right.
to turn, because that's all they'll give you every day. If you want to be outraged about the liberal media and the mainstream media and how they're attacking the president, you know where on Fox to turn.
So you've written about rightful outrage, our fear of the rightful outrage that we may feel about Donald Trump, or that Donald Trump supporters might feel about the rest of the nation. And we're not getting at the deep, personal, soulful anxiety of Donald Trump or life in Donald Trump's America, which requires, you say, a new journalistic enterprise, a rethinking of how we tell stories. What would that look like?
Yeah, before we talk about that, I mean, I do think it's worth pausing to especially to talk to people who really dislike the press, or who think the press is not honest, or who think that they're not being fair. I think all of those are sort of legitimate arguments to make. But when we start getting into the zone of even questioning whether a free press is an institution that we care about in America, or that the First Amendment is very important at all, I think that gets into very dangerous territory. And I think that is the point at which even people who support Trump need to stop and say, like, is this really the path that we want to go down? Is this are these sort of fundamental principles of this country things that we really want to abandon? I think most people would say no. So that's that. On the question, I do think that there is a and partly it has to do with the siloization that we were just talking about. Like, I'm not sure it's continuing to be effective to say to do stories that sort of where we have one side expressing outrage, you go to the other side that attacks the first side, and you have this sort of ping pong thing back and forth, and everybody says the sort of talking points. And you see this especially on TV,
mm-hmm.
where you have, you know, Trump will do something, people will be outraged, and the Trump spokespeople will say, well, either that's fake or these people are completely are nonsense or whatever. And there's not a lot of light being shown on the situation. I mean, I think we need to get away from that sort of back and forth thing, and you know, we need to, and this is why I've been sort of calling for a while for, like, are there different ways of telling these stories? Are there first person stories that would be more effective than this kind of back and forth spokesman thing? Are there kind of deep dive, kind of analytical approaches? I'm a big fan in print of oral histories, where you basically find a bunch of people who are involved in the situation and have them tell their part of the story in a kind of first-person way. And you sort of pull the reporter out of the scene, and you pull, you know, you just let the people who live this talk themselves. That's what I mean. I mean, I think we just need to be looking for different kind of forms. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we're at, you know, CJR, we do a lot of first-person pieces by people who's just lived situations that we think are interesting. And again, it pulls the reporter as intermediary out of the equation. So it sort of keeps that distraction from happening. But I think we just need to put a lot of thought into how we tell stories now.
In the meantime, in the 2 minutes that we have left, how would you suggest the president be covered? Should we be covering his tweets every day? Should we be covering his rallies every time he has a rally? Because it's pretty much the same message that he has for his followers, and it's pretty much the same environment.
That's the point. I mean, I think, you know, if he says that he hates, you know, that CNN is fake or that the New York Times is failing, it's worth covering. If he says it 10 times, maybe less. If he says it 30 times, why are we continuing to repeat this? I just think we need some kind of perspective on this. And the rallies are similar. I mean, he is the president, and he is going to these places, and he is saying things. But if he's just saying the same thing over and over again, I don't know why we need to keep reporting out the way we do. I mean, I think he has a very keen sense of what the press is going to respond to, and I think he knows the language that's going to trigger people, and he uses it. But I think we just need to show a little bit more judgment and sort of stepping back a little bit more.
What about the White House press briefings? It's been alleged by many reporters that it's a daily dishing of lies, and that Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary, does not take issue with the lies that the president tells and won't tell the truth. Should the White House or should networks stop going to the press meetings at the White House? What's the point?
Yeah, I mean, this has been, you know, I'm old enough to remember when Sam Donaldson was doing these press briefings with Ronald Reagan, and he would yell, and it's sort of performance art a bit, right, on both sides. Mm-hmm. And I think this is exactly the same. I mean, look, there's a lot of reporters who have really made careers for themselves in the last 2 years in a very public way with these press briefings. But I mean, I don't think it's very disputable that the press secretary lies, and her predecessors lied. And actually, you know, you could even argue that press secretaries over time have, if not lied, then definitely shaded truth to where they want it. I'm very glad that we're out of the zone where those briefings are being shown live on television, because I thought that was silly. You get these situations where and I do have sympathy for the reporters in the room. I mean, stuff will happen. She'll just deny it or say something completely opposite to what the truth is or attack the reporters. And it's hard to sort of contain yourself. I understand from a personal level, like, how the situation these reporters are in, but I just don't think it advances the conversation. I don't think it sheds much light. I personally would really scale it back. I mean, you remember when early on, when these things were like really sort of hot tickets, when Sean Spicer was there, a lot of news outlets stream them. They stream them over their websites and whatever. I'm not sure that that's not a bad idea, having a lot fewer people in the room, and letting you know, news outlets just sort of stream it over their websites and let people watch or not watch. But I just think this sort of kabuki dance of outrage on both sides doesn't really work.
So you have to have a free press in order for a country like this to operate, and it's, of course, enshrined in the Constitution.
I mean, it's baked into the founding of the country.
Right. But if you've lost the confidence of at least 30% of the voters of the electorate, how do you you've laid out some ideas about how we get that back by the way we tell stories and changing the way we tell stories and changing the focus of the story. But you're with the Columbia Journalism Review. Are these conversations being held in the newsroom at the New York Times, at CBS News, at Fox News, for that matter? Are they having these conversations?
They are having these conversations there, but I don't think that's what's going to move the needle. I think these conversations need to be happening in Charlotte and in Kansas City and in Portland and in Albuquerque. And I think what we really need to be talking about, I mean, look, everybody's going about their own life. Everybody's busy. They're trying to get their kids to school. They're trying to sort of keep their job, whatever. They're not that interested in our, like, shrieking about how our profession is in peril. That's not going to really move the needle, I don't think. I think what we need to do is really communicate, like, do you care if, you know, and these are real stories, do you care if there's a gymnastics teacher in your town who is abusing kids? Is that important to you? Is it important that you know that? Do you care if there's a chemical plant upstream from your town that's dumping junk into the river and that's affecting your water supply? Does that matter to you? Do you care if there's a city manager in your town who's siphoning money that's supposed to go to the school board? These are all real stories that have been written by real reporters in real towns. And I think most people, regardless of how they think about Trump, would say, yeah, that's important to me. I care about that. And a free press is important because it gives me that kind of information. So I think we need to step away from we are under siege and we are a sort of protected class of people, which I don't think is a very good argument, and focus more on the work and how the work is important to what to the way people live their lives. That's the argument I think that is going to ultimately make the difference.
Kyle Pope is editor and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.